Morning, everyone. So I'll be reading from the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 9, verses 1 to 12. If you need a physical copy of the Bible, just raise your hand and one of our lovely ushers will get you one. Ecclesiastes, chapter 9, verses 1 to 12. So I reflected on all this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands, but no one knows whether love or hate awaits them. All share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As it is with the good, so with the sinful, as it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. The hearts of people, moreover, are full of evil. And there is madness in their hearts while they live, and afterward they join the dead. Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even their name is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. Go, eat your food with gladness, and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. Always be clothed in white, and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the realm of the dead, where you are going, there is neither working nor planning, nor knowledge nor wisdom. I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong. Nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned. But time and chance happen to them all. Moreover, no one knows when their hour will come. As fish are caught in a cruel net, or birds are taken in a snare, so people are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly upon them. Here ends the reading.
My most considered like successful moment of my life was the worst, the most depressed I've ever been. Literally feeling like I'd probably be happier if I was just dead. I got a number one on the Billboard. My song is massive right now. Like, I may never have a song this big again. My tour, I think every date sold out except one date. So I literally had everything that I'd always dreamed of happening. And I didn't feel happy at all. And so I think what happened was I spiraled really bad. Because I was like, I'm here. And if this is it, there's got to be more for me. Because if this is it, like...
That little YouTube clip there is from, the guy speaking is an American rapper named Nate Feuerstein. He goes by the name NF, just his initials. He's a rapper who's a Christian, but he doesn't like being labeled a Christian rapper. And actually, sometimes if you read about him, he's called the next Eminem because he's white and he's a rapper and he's from Michigan. But I think actually if you like rap music, that's kind of a little bit of a blasphemy if you say that. Now, the little snippet that you just listened to is a track from his album, which is titled The Search. And he's describing the moment when he reached the top of the mountain that he's been climbing his whole life. And he's telling you what he found there. He said, my most considered successful moment of my life was the worst, the most depressed I've ever been. He reached the top of the mountain. He's accomplished massive success by any standard as a musician. Lots of money, lots of fame, lots of recognition, lots of emptiness. He said, I literally had everything that I always dreamed of happening, and I didn't feel happy at all. You see, he climbed the mountain to find success, but after he found it, he realized that he was actually looking for the wrong thing all this whole time. Because he didn't actually want success. He wanted peace. And instead of peace, he found a crushing emptiness. As we come near to the end of our series on the book of Ecclesiastes, it's time to reveal to you the great plot twist of this book. You see, for weeks, Reverend Ying and Reverend Winston and I have actually been misleading you. We've been telling you that Ecclesiastes is a book of wisdom, but it's not actually a book of wisdom. It's a book of disappointment. It disappoints. It's about someone who's reached the top and looked around and said, is this it? It cannot possibly be it. This can't be it, right? There's got to be more to this. I'm begging you. Because if this is what the top looks like, feels like, then I'm not sure that life is worth living. Now, the good news is that this isn't all there is. The good news is that Ecclesiastes is only disappointing because it's incomplete. When we look past Ecclesiastes to the proper end of the story, we actually don't find disappointment. We find something deep and true and beautiful. We find hope. We find hope. Let's pray. Father God, we're all on the grind, and to some extent, we've all had a taste of achievement and success, getting what we want, and then realizing that's not what we wanted at all. And we've had our fair share of losses. We've had our fair share of disappointments. Answer our question now. Tell us what life is all about, why it's worth living, and help us to encounter true wisdom, not in words of advice, but in the Word, the person of your Son. Amen. Now, on its face, the book of Ecclesiastes is written by someone who is supposedly the best that humanity has to offer. So he was a wealthy and powerful man, he tells us. He tells us that he was a teacher. He calls himself a teacher. He claims to be a king of Israel. And he claims to have leveraged his immense wealth and power and privilege towards just one goal and one goal only, and that's getting wisdom. And so the way I want you to think of this book is through that classic cheerleading rant. You know that rant, teacher, he's our man. If he can't do it, no one can. That's the whole book. That's what it's all about. If he can't do it, then no one can. And what's it? Oh, very simple. It's figuring out the secret to life and meaning and ultimate happiness. And the very important thing that you need to know and understand right from the beginning is that the teacher failed. He failed. What we're reading about is all the wisdom that he has gained. That's what Ecclesiastes is. But it's sloppy and it's aimless and it's full of contradiction. In fact, our passage today is full of contradiction, and I'll show you that in just a moment. But the important question that we need to answer is why? Why did he fail? What was he missing? What did he miss that caused him to not be able to succeed in his wisdom project? Now, a couple of weeks ago, I told you that one way to sort of frame all the wisdom that the teacher shares in this book is through this formula. You would think, but in reality, okay? That's kind of the way that he sort of expresses his wisdom. For example, you would think that koalas, being all cute and cuddly, would be very friendly and you can pick them up and hug them, but in reality, they're actually quite vicious and dangerous and diseased. You would think, but in reality. So with that in mind, read with me verse 1. Chapter 9, verse 1, the first thing we read together. He says, so I reflected on all this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands, but no one knows whether love or hate awaits them. So he says, after all my reflection and thinking and searching, here's my observation. The righteous and the wise are in God's hands. Actually, to be more accurate, no matter how righteous and how wise you are still not in your own hands. You are in God's hands. You are never in control, no matter how good your life is, no matter how wise you live. You would think that the more righteous you are, the wiser you are, you'd be a little bit more better off than the dumb and foolish, right? The more righteous you are, the more in control of your destiny you would be. But in reality, he's discovered that there's no correlation between your godliness and your agency in your life. Now, why is that a bad thing? Well, simply put, because of how unfair it is. Look at verse 2. He says, all share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. You see, in a fair world, you would expect that good things will happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people as they deserve. That's what we call justice. But the teacher says that from everything that he's seen and learned, it's actually the opposite. He says the world is profoundly unjust. Good people suffer, and evil people are rewarded for their evil. Further down, skip down to verse 11, he actually makes this even clearer. He says, I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, or the food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. You see, you would think that in a good world, the race would be won by the swift, food would be available to the wise, and wealth goes to the brilliant, etc., etc. But none of that is true, because life is unfair. Life is not given to order, but to random chance. Now, how's that for a punch in the gut? And on top of that, here's the ultimate injustice. Good or bad, we all share the same destiny. Good people suffer, and then they die. Evil people are rewarded for their evil deeds, and then they die. Chapter 9, verse 3. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. You see, that's the problem right there. This common destiny chokes all the life and joy and meaning out of existence. Because if the end is set in stone, and it's the same for you or for me or for good people or for bad people or for righteous people or unrighteous people, and we're all going to face the same end no matter what, then what's the point of everything we do while we still have breath in our lungs? What is the point of it all? All your labor, all your sorrow, all your striving, all your blood and sweat and tears for the accomplishments you go for. And in the end, you'll still become worm food. Just like Gandhi, just like Hitler, just like Mother Teresa, just like Osama bin Laden, just like Charlie Kirk. So what does it matter then, if you're dead or alive? Does it make a difference? In fact, it seems to me that if you're dead, then you actually at least have one advantage over the living, which is that you don't have to live with the knowledge of this crushingly bleak truth anymore. Wouldn't it be nice to just end your suffering? Because in the end, it doesn't even matter. Now, you know how I said that the teacher's wisdom can be a bit sloppy and a little bit inconsistent? Well, here in the next part that we're going to look at, that's where it really comes out for you, okay? So far, his observation is, no matter what, if you live a good or evil life, a wise or foolish life, you're going to die anyway. And so the logical conclusion that you should reach is that, well, then there's no point to life, right? Well, check out what he says in the very next verse, verse 4. Anyone who is among the living has hope. And he says, even a live dog is better than a dead lion. Now, after 9 chapters of morbidly pessimistic observations about life, he then has the audacity to talk about hope. He says that if you're living, well, you at least have hope. But hang on, doesn't that directly contradict the verse before where he says the same destiny overtakes all? Right? And then he says in verse 5, the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, even their name is forgotten. So he says, I say, if it's all the same, doesn't matter if you're living or dead. Then he says, it still matters. Against everything that life has shown him, this teacher still fights for life. There shouldn't be any hope for the living. It's all meaningless, and yet he stubbornly fights for some kind of raison d'etre, reason to go on living. within the teacher's wisdom, he's got a bleak but accurate truth, but then that truth comes with this emptiness that he refuses to accept. He says, there's got to be more than this. There's got to be a reason for hope. Now, the French existentialist Albert Camus really understood the predicament that the teacher was in. In his essay, The Myth of Sisyphus, Camus calls this problem facing the absurd. He says the absurd is when you get face to face with this contradiction. He says man stands face to face with the irrational. He feels within him his longing for happiness and for reason. And the absurd is born of this confrontation between this human need for reason and the unreasonable silence of the world. So, where are we then? Here's where we stand so far. The teacher's made two problematic claims so far in our passage. Claim number one, life is pointless because no matter how you live it, you're going to die. And then claim number two, yet somehow, living is still better than dying. Now, in this next part, what he's going to do is he's going to take these two claims, which contradict each other, and then he's going to perform some mental gymnastics in order to try to make them work together and then process it and then try to give you some decent life advice. Okay? So let's see how he does. Verse 7. Go, eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved of what you do. In other words, what does he say? Oh, go on and try to live your best life anyway. Life is unfair and lacking sense. Go, eat with gladness anyway. Go, drink your wine anyway. So what is he saying? Well, in other words, just try. Try to be happy. Try to imagine yourself happy. Verse 8, always be clothed in white. And always anoint your head in oil. Don't let the crushing reality of this pointless existence bring you down and leave you living at home and a shut-in. See, his advice is still to go about life as if it had meaning. Don't just give up. Don't wallow around in self-pity at home, you know, wearing baggy sweatpants and a hoodie and lock yourself away from the world and sustaining yourself with those empty dopamine hits like gaming and watching porn and ordering food from Uber Eats and doom scrolling your TikTok videos while your brain gradually liquefies like a puddle of aeroplane jelly on the sidewalk. See, all of that would make a lot of sense if you really understood the world for what it is. But then the teacher says, don't do that. Don't do that. Fight for life. But why? How? He goes on. Verse 9. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. I think for my money, this is probably the most contradictory verse in the whole section that we've been looking at today. He says, my students of life, listen to the teacher. The teacher, let me tell you, this is the best that you can hope for. This is your lot in life. Meaningless days, toilsome labor, but enjoy it. Why not? If you have a wife, enjoy it with your wife. Seriously though, okay, what is this, right? Thanks a lot, teacher. Thanks for nothing. What a profound disappointment. 0 out of 10. Would not recommend. So with all this behind us now, we go back to our key question then. What was the teacher missing? Why did he fail? Why was his wisdom project a failure? Could you have done better than him? I used to get really bad earaches when I'm on a plane. Anyone get bad earaches? You know, like when the plane's ascending or descending, your ears pop or doesn't pop, and then the air pressure really hurts and you can't hear anything. It's all muffled and stuff. I get it really bad. Don't like it. One time, this was lots of years ago, after I had landed, I tried doing that popping your ears trick. You know what I mean? You plug your nose and you blow out as hard as you can and try to equalize the pressure in your eardrum. And I did this. I was walking towards baggage claim, and I do the thing, and I hear a pop, and then all of a sudden I feel that relief. But then shortly after that, my world started to spin, and I started getting really dizzy, and I feel like I'm going to fall over. So I quickly sit down just right in the middle of the walkway because I didn't want to, you know, like be that loser who fell over and had a fainting episode, right? So I sit down and then everything's still spinning and then I'm slowly starting to panic. And now I'm thinking, okay, I just need to get lower. So I lie down flat on the ground. There's people with their luggage walking past me on both ways. And the spinning doesn't stop. And in fact, as I lie down, it gets worse. And I feel like I'm on a roller coaster and I'm looking up and the ceiling is spinning like a graduation cap. And I feel like I'm about to throw up. Now, you guys know what happened, right? Or at least those with medical training. I was having a sudden case of vertigo. It happens from time to time when you mess around with your inner ear, right? Now, I probably just popped my ear too hard and did some stuff. I don't know. Go ask Jeremy Tam later. Now, I think the whole thing lasted maybe like 40 or 50 seconds. Definitely no more than a minute. And yet to me, that whole time, it felt like an eternity. And I got to be honest with you, it was so unbearable. At one point, as I was lying there, I thought to myself, if this just keeps going on, and it doesn't end, I'm going to have to think of a way to end myself. It was that scary. Now, vertigo is a medical condition that happens when your brain gets its wires crossed about your body in the world. So your inner ear says to your brain, hey, 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 we're spinning. But then your eyes say, no, we're not. And then your brain's like, hang on, wait a second. Which one of you is lying here? And as a result, you get dizzy. And then you think that the world's moving, but it's not really. And then you lose your sense of up and down and left and right. And when you have vertigo, what's going on is your sense of reality becomes distorted in a very uncomfortable and disorienting way. It's actually pretty torturous. Now, I'm telling you all this because if you want to understand the central conceit of Ecclesiastes, you can think of it as a sort of vertigo. It's a vertigo. Now, there's a phrase in Ecclesiastes that we really haven't talked about much, but it's practically like the key catchphrase of the whole book. And that phrase is under the sun, under the sun. Now, the big idea of Ecclesiastes isn't that life is meaningless. It's life is meaningless under the sun. Now, what does under the sun actually mean? Well, if you've been a Christian for a little while, and this is the first time you've read Ecclesiastes, you might have heard it explained as life under the sun simply means life without God. Now, I think that's true, but I actually think it's just a little bit of an oversimplification. I think what under the sun means is a little bit more than just simply not knowing God. You see, just like having vertigo, life under the sun is actually about having a distorted sense perception. The world doesn't change. God doesn't change. Reality doesn't change. The truth remains the truth. But somewhere in your heart, you've got your wires crossed and you cannot sense the deeper spiritual reality that constitutes the true nature of our world. And so at a spiritual level, here's what's going on. The metaphorical inner ear of your spiritual perception is broken. But the spiritual is what gives our lives its meaning and its weightiness and its importance. And if you don't have your connection to the spiritual, then life feels pointless. It's an inescapable conclusion. But there's another part of our heart that's still in touch with the truth. And so we're confused and we're talking to our hearts and we're like, okay, who's doing the lying here? Because there's nothing new under the sun and life is meaningless. But in my heart, I feel like life is not meaningless. And all of this is disorienting and uncomfortable and makes us nauseous and makes us throw up. I call this vertigo because I think that's what's happening. It's a vertigo that doesn't affect your relationship with the physical world. It's one that affects your relationship with heaven. It distorts your connection with all of spiritual reality. So I'll give you an example. Have you ever heard the question, are we just a collection of atoms, or is there something more to human life? What's that question actually about? Well, that question is asking, well, is there something more to the physical world? Is physical reality all there is, or is there something greater? What do you think? How would you answer this question? Is there something sacred about human life? And if there is, how would you know? Well, you can't tell, can you? You can't tell from observing the world. All you can do is say, I feel it in here. Is there something holy to human activity, to human affairs? Am I just a bag of meat? Or is there something more to who I am? See, if you have vertical vertigo, you understand the physical, but you can't clearly see the spiritual reality that underpins everything in life. It's not completely gone, it's just distorted. Like from time to time, you'll get snippets of the truth, but for the most part, you can't rely on your senses. You can't reliably tell the difference between spiritual truth and falsehood. It's very confusing and dizzying. In theology, this is sometimes called the noetic effects of the fall. Noetic effects, it comes from the Greek word for mind or brain. It's the effects that sin has on your intellectual capacity, on your intellectual self. Sin distorts your reason and your intellect and your perception of reality. The Christian pre-existentialist philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, actually I should say, he doesn't like being known as a Christian philosopher, he's just a philosopher. What is it with Christian these and that? And they're like, oh, don't call me a Christian this or that, I'm just a this or that. Anyway, Søren Kierkegaard, he's a philosopher, and he talks about this in his book, The Sickness Unto Death. In fact, that's what he calls it. He calls it the sickness unto death. He says that's the sickness that we all suffer from. It's the sickness that the teacher has been talking about this whole time. Chapter 3, verse 11, we didn't look at it today, but if you're a fast flipper, have a look at chapter 3, verse 11. He says, he, meaning God, God has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. This is suffering. Because when you have vertical vertigo, the world just looks to you like a cold and indifferent and meaningless place. There's nothing sacred and holy about a human being. Under the sun, you and I, all of us, were just arbitrary arrangements of atoms in an accidental universe. And yet some deep part of our hearts cries out against this, rails against this, refuses to accept what our eyes are telling us. And if you get this dilemma, then you get Ecclesiastes. Now you get what the teacher was missing. Now, two observations before we move on. Okay. Vertical, vertigo. First of all, everything that I've just described here is a broad observation about our society right now in this present age. What I mean is I'm making broad sweeping generalizations about culture and society, okay? Our society as a whole suffers from vertical vertigo, all right? Now, this one's more for you, I guess this section here, you uni young crowd, those of you who are still going through your emo existentialist identity crisis phase. If you are trying to figure out who you are and the pointlessness of the world, check out the writings of Jean-Paul Sartre. He's sort of the poster child of the existentialist movement. In his novel, Nausea, he says, I exist, that's all, and I find it nauseating. That's what he says. And for the most part, he still carries pull, even almost a century later, because he's really put his finger on this collective condition that we all have. We all collectively have vertigo. Now, that's the first thing. But the second thing, and this is really, really, really important, okay? The second thing is that the whole point of the church is that we ought not to suffer from that. You see, as Christians, we are in the world, but we are not of it. We are not given over to the same conditions and ailments and afflictions that the rest of the world suffer from. And so we're not meant to be a gathering of hopeless people sitting around and singing a funeral song for human civilization. This room is meant to be a place of light and life and hope against this darkness. And our songs ought to be messages of hope. And we sing them from the margins of society, as it were. We are not part of society, even though we live and walk amongst them, we do business with them, we shop, we are part of this world, but we are not of this world. We are meant to stand apart and speak words and truths of hope from above that this world cannot find. The rest of this world is like, teacher, can't see any way out of this. And if it weren't for God's grace, we would be in the same situation. But we're not in that situation. We do have hope. We do have meaning. We do have purpose. We have a reason to live. And our purpose is to be a light, pointing the rest of the world towards that hope. Very important. I'll talk more about that in just a moment. Now, if everything under the sun is meaningless, then where can you find wisdom? Well, that's a trick question, okay? It's a trick question. You don't find wisdom. You cannot find wisdom. Wisdom finds you. In ancient Jewish thought, there was this deeply held belief about the fundamental nature of our world. And this belief underpins the way they see everything in reality. And this belief was that the world was not only created, but it was created with order. That's one of the deepest philosophical assumptions, part of the cosmology, if you will, of ancient Jewish thought. The world was not an accident. It didn't come about through natural processes, evolution, or whatever you want to say. It was designed. And it wasn't just designed, it was designed with purpose and logic and sense. Now, you all probably know that in Genesis chapter 1, it said God created the world. But what was equally important wasn't just that God created the world, but it was how God created the world. God created the world with his words. Right there in the very first verses of the Bible, it says that he spoke the cosmos into existence. Let there be light. And then there was light. Now, to the Jews, this was really, really important because it told us some very, very important things. It told us that, first of all, the fundamental nature of the world was that it was logical. It was made to make sense. It was ordered, right? But secondly, it also told us about the person that stood behind it. Now, where the teacher leaves us is that the God created the world with wisdom, but he's not able to really find any of that wisdom or order in the world. So he knows Genesis chapter 1. He's like, God created the world. He spoke it into existence. And then he did this day 1, this day 2, this day 3, this. And it was all very perfectly thought out. But then I look out at the world and all I see is chaos. So what's going on? And so the readers of Ecclesiastes would be left with a longing. It's designed to make you dissatisfied. And anticipation for God to restore the wisdom and the order that had been robbed from his creation. And you know, all throughout the Old Testament, there were hints and whispers of it. Just little clues, allusions, if you will, and sometimes full-on prophecies. Prophecies of a wisdom to come, of God making it all right, of God bringing a wisdom that will order for us all the chaos under the sun. The great plot twist was that when that wisdom came, it didn't come as words, but it came as the Word. In John chapter 1, verse 14, it says, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father." Now you see, this plot twist gave everyone at the time a mild case of vertigo because they weren't expecting that. They were expecting some kind of a holy law, a holy way of living that God said, do this and you'll be fine. But then a person came and they were all like, hang on a second, how could wisdom be a person? Well, that's the point. God said that it would not be magic words that was going to bring you rest from your striving. or meaning to your pointless life, but a person. Now, here is why the word is better than words. Because words can instruct. That's what Ecclesiastes does. Do this and don't do that. You should be fine. But the word doesn't instruct. He shepherds. He's your shepherd. Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. And that's another reason why the word is better than words. Because words are impersonal and general. They're like, everyone, do this and you'll be fine. Don't do this and you'll be fine. Words don't know you. The word knows you. The word became flesh and came to know you so that you might be intimately known and loved. And here's the most important thing of all. Words say do this and don't do that. The teacher says, you know what? Go, live in gladness. Love your wife if you have one. And dress up in clothes of white. Don't be all depressed. Wear your stained sweatpants and all that kind of thing. And do that and you'll be fine. But the word doesn't do that. He doesn't say, do this. He says, this is what I've done for you. You see, if you are expecting salvation in the form of words, then you've got a problem. What if I fail? What if the secret to meaning and happiness is something that I can't achieve? Something that I can't do? What if it's impossible? The good news of the wisdom that comes from God is that that wisdom came and did what we couldn't do for us. He didn't say, oh, this is the way to and the truth and the life. He says, I am the way and the truth and the life. And so Jesus says, put your trust in me because I have done it. I have died the death that was required to end your case of vertigo. I have come to end your suffering. You suffered enough. You suffered enough under the sun. All your striving, your failures, your brokenness, your searching, it ends here. Come meet the one who won't point the way to salvation for you. He is the way. He is the way to salvation for you. And you see, this is what this community is all about. This is what our faith is all about. We are a people who are set apart from this world, who don't share the common destiny of this world. The teacher said, the problem is that all share a common destiny. Good or bad, righteous or wicked, you will end up in the grave. But Jesus has defeated the grave. He has ended the grave, and he has split off for himself those who aren't going to end in that terrible destiny. And he says, believe in me, and come, and I will save you out of this. And so, as I finish up, I want to tell you, what I really want to say is, first of all, if this is the first time that you've really heard this message, or if that's really like processed down in your heart for you, come and find out more. Come and meet this Jesus, if you're not feeling like you're someone who's really properly met wisdom yet. But secondly, I think I really feel big about this one. For those of you in the church, let me ask you to wake up. Wake up into this holy calling. Because of this, God has called us to be a prophetic people, a people who declare these words of truth to an unbelieving and hopeless generation. And that's what we're meant to do. And we're not meant to continue the rat race, to continue the striving and the toiling and the endless wheel that never changes. We're meant to break out of it and lead others to break out of it. So that's what this church is all about. That's what everything we do here is all about. Church planting, our upcoming renewal project, which you're going to hear about. Redemptive parenting is strengthening and equipping our families so they can be families of prophecy into this world. All of it. This is our reason for existence. This is what we're all about. I'll just throw up one slide real quick. I think I'm out of time to actually talk about it. But this is what I think I'm going to have to do it some other time. But I'll just say that what we, three things that I ask you to strive for, and I won't make further comment. The next one, please, Jeff. Application, be poor, live counterculturally. The world strives for riches and wealth. Don't strive for that. Be poor, spiritually poor. Be wrong. The world's going to tell you that you're wrong because it can't see what you see. It doesn't have the hope that you have. And lastly, be prayerful. Be prophets to this world. Speak words of God to them, but then be priests to this world as well. Pray for them and be mediators between hopeless people and God. Okay, I think that's all I have time to say. Let's pray. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 14. Wake up, O sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ shine on you. Father, shine on us. Shed for us the light of your holy wisdom in your Son, Jesus, who is the way, the truth, and the life. Amen.